Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common Magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. Today, we'll be talking to Catherine Vaz about her story, The Treasure Hunt of August Diaz, which appears in issue 20 of The Common. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Catherine Vaz is the author of the novels Saudade and Mariana, the latter translated in six languages. Her story collection, Fado and Other Stories, won the Drew Hines Literature Prize, and the collection, Our Lady of the Artichokes and Other Portuguese-American Stories, won the Prairie Schooner Book Prize. She's the first Portuguese-American to have her work recorded for the archives of the Library of Congress, and she served on the six-person presidential delegation to the World's Fair in Lisbon in 1998. She is a teacher of writing the Luso Experience, a workshop at the Disquiet Conference each summer in Lisbon. Catherine Vaz, thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm so happy to be here, Emily. I love The Common magazine, so this is a real treat for me.
Yeah, we're so glad to talk with you. Would you set the scene for our conversation and describe where you're living and where you're calling from?
Yes, I'm right now in very, very snowy New York City. I live in the middle of Manhattan with my husband in our mutual national, international lockdown. I originally was born and raised in California, but I've lived in the East Coast quite a long time now. And my father was from the Azores, which will be significant in a lot of what we talk about and in a lot of the things I've written.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for introing your family background as well. I was going to ask you to do that. I would love to start off with a reading from your story. Would you read that first paragraph for us?
I would love to. Thank you, Emily. This is the first paragraph from the Treasure Hunt of August Diaz. The apricot tree in my childhood yard would seethe the night. Pouring through the openwork of the leaves, the moonlight littered the ground with patches shaped like bats. Because we lived in the Sunset District of San Francisco, sea drafts kept ruffling the leaves, so the bats were always fluttering their wings. Sometimes I would lie down and let the light bats tap all over me. We lived in the bottom flat of a spindly three-story home, and there was a fig tree, too, and blackberries on brambles thick as the Lord's crown of thorns, right in the heart of the city. We had picnics with the cajadas my father made, the coconut tarts that were a specialty of his family's bakery on the island of Terceira in the Azores. His job while raising me, his only child, was fulfilling dessert orders for restaurants. And he rented a tiny industrial kitchen in Chinatown from 3 to 9 in the morning. Once, a triumph, the Tadich Grill requested his Alfaning to decorate their pastry cart, the white sugar confection molded into doves or miniature baskets.
Thanks for reading that. I think that opening paragraph really gives us a sense of the story and how vast it is. Would you describe what the piece is about just for our listeners who haven't read it yet?
Yes, this story is very special to me because it's one I've been trying to write for many, many years. And it's about a father dying and his daughter coming to grips with that. She moves back as a young woman into her childhood home in San Francisco. And her father creates a treasure hunt for her to go on through the city. And though it's a city that they've lived in and that she grew up in, San Francisco, it's a way of getting her up and around so she doesn't fall inside grief. And also because in his dying days, they will have things to talk about that relate to to life itself, to making discoveries, to finding clues and following them. In a personal way, I lost my own father a few years ago, and he loved making treasure hunts up for us. He would put them around our yard, and we would follow them. I've always been fascinated by scavenger hunts and that kind of thing as well. There's a particular book mentioned in my story that was quite a sensation for those of us who are, I would say, probably over 60 years old. It was a book called Masquerade, done by an English artist named Kit Williams. And it's hard to capture how gripped everyone was with reading that book, looking at the paintings he had done and trying to find the jewel he had buried. It didn't occur to us that if we lived in England, we'd have a better chance of finding it. But anyway, this story is a tribute. It's a Valentine to San Francisco, and it's a Valentine to my late father and to the fascination of, you might say, discovering and rediscovering the places we live, to fall in love with a place as well as a person.
That's a beautiful description of what the story is about. Would you say, I guess I was kind of under the impression that you had written this story fairly quickly, but you already kind of had the outline or the general idea of it. But is that not the case? Did it take you a long time to write?
The funny thing is, and I give a lot of credit to editor Jennifer Acker and to you and to everyone else at The Common. I wrote a story to submit for the special Lusso issue. And for your listeners who may not know what that means, Lusso American means Portuguese American. The reason for that is because the old Roman word for Portugal was Lusitania. So Lusso Americans are Portuguese Americans. And I, you know, really wanted, a lot of my life's work has been about growing up in the Portuguese American community. And I turned in a story that I read over, and then I thought, you know, I really don't like it. I don't think I've ever said that to an editor. I don't think I've ever said, you know what, I'm reading this over and I'm making that fundamental mistake of the backstory seems more interesting than the main one. So Jennifer was really generous and she said, you want to try something else? And I thought, let me see if I can finally do this treasure hunt story I've wanted to do for years. There was a, you might say almost a fad for a while, a number of years ago, with what were called armchair treasure hunts, based on this book Masquerade that I just talked about. Mm-hmm. And they've fallen by the wayside now because people got a little obsessed with them. But I've always wanted to do that. So frankly, my inspiration was having a really short deadline and just thinking, all right. And, you know, I was very close to my father and I was there when he died a few years ago. He died within 40 hours of me going back home to California. Wow. And so you might say just the pain of writing about that made me want to put it down as quickly as I could. So that, that was an impetus, you might say, but there's nothing like a deadline to inspire creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially if you've been kind of mulling it over for years. I mean, I think.
Floating around in my head, I'd like to do something that's about that, but I didn't have the story. I had the idea, which is, as everyone knows, is very different.
Yes, not quite halfway. So I was going to ask you, we often work with writers on edits to a story, and I know that you worked on some revisions on this story with Jennifer Acker, our editor-in-chief, who you mentioned before. Do you want to talk a little bit about that process? Like, what's it like to get feedback and deciding what changes you want to make based on that feedback?
Sure. I think I'm lucky in that I've worked with a lot of extremely perceptive and generous and big-hearted editors. And I I don't want to be a trial for readers. I want to have them fall into the world of a story I write and enjoy it and not feel like, okay, I'm lost. So I really take it as guideposts and guidelines when an editor says, you know, I don't know what you're talking about here, or I got confused. And also because I want my characters to be active, not just walking around thinking about things. And so I enjoy the process. And many editors are also writers themselves. So it strikes me as very generous to go into someone else's mindset and world and truly try to help them. I've always had very, very good luck with editors. And, you know, Jennifer was one of them. And I guess my personality is also I'm detail oriented. So I need help in sometimes getting rid of extraneous details. But I also really enjoy working with people who are minute about things, like saying, oh, okay, you've got this word here and then again here. And I like to fine tune things. And so I work really well with editors who like to do that too.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. I love the idea that some of the most helpful feedback is just hearing what the reader experiences when they're reading it. Like, I found this part confusing, or I didn't know what you meant there. Like, I agree that is almost more helpful than someone telling you like exactly what the story needs or exactly what should be done.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like, where did you feel like you could put it down and walk away and come back to it? I had an editor who gave me really good advice once, which it sounds very simple, but she said, okay, I'm not clear about this line you have here. What are you trying to say here? And she said, just say it and then put that in. And I stop myself and think of that a lot when I'm working on something. Okay, what do you mean here? And don't make the reader find it out. You do the work. And why don't you just say it the way you mean it? So that sounded like a very simple bit of advice, but really was very helpful.
Yeah, I really love that. That's something I'm quite passionate about as an editor, I think. And I know that Jennifer is as well, that there's so much pressure on writers these days to show instead of telling. And I think it just... sometimes we go a little too far in that direction and we lose a lot of clarity, which can be very frustrating for readers. And why not make it a little easier?
Yeah. As you know, sometimes just tell me what happens here and let's move on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Fernando Pessoa is a Portuguese modernist poet who's gotten very, very popular. And he has this wonderful line about, you may come up with the perfect word, but that doesn't mean it's in the perfect sentence. You may have the perfect sentence, but it doesn't mean it's going to be in a perfect paragraph, and so on and so forth. So I think just, you know, it's the show, not tell workshop familiar line, but sometimes you just have to tell people certain things, and it can suture things and move things along. So pacing is very important too.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So this story appears in our portfolio, as you mentioned. It was writing from the Lusosphere, which is Portugal. It's colonial, cultural, linguistic diaspora. And it's one of several beautiful pieces we have by Portuguese American writers in that issue. And I think that they're really diverse pieces, and it made me wonder, do you think there is something specific that characterizes Portuguese American writing? Are there certain themes or styles or ideas that you often find in that world, or is it just too broad to really summarize?
Well, I think each person is an individual who's going to have a unique voice. I mean, that goes without saying. I guess that's the qualifier. In my case, I come from not just Portuguese, but Azorean roots, and the Azores are, you know, an archipelago of nine islands in the middle of the Atlantic. Most of the Portuguese immigrants, certainly in California and in other places too, were from the Azores, not really from the mainland. So you might say the idea of island culture or the sensibility that comes out of being in a geographically small place can really affect sensibility. There's a 19th century Portuguese writer named Essa de Queiroz who described the Portuguese temperament as jittery melancholia, which I just love. And so I would say I will get in trouble if I don't mention saudade, which is a very Portuguese word that means it's supposed to be one of those impossible to define words. Mm-hmm. It's been called sweet sadness, longing. I describe it as the presence of an absence, a longing for people or time or place that you may not even have ever seen. It's a kind of longing. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of Portuguese writing has that kind of longing, and it's historic too, because people in small countries, I bet a lot of Irish writers could say the same, the children grow up to leave in a lot of cases. So sure. There's a kind of sensibility, but I'll tell you a very, very, I think there's a kind of sensibility to color. I think my father had a kind of variety of synesthesia color thinking. I wish I could say the same. I don't have that, but I think my father had a kind of real sharp attunement to color. But I'll tell you a really brief story that I think describes Portuguese writing or sensibility, and a lot of other people can identify with it also. I have a dear friend who's an historian in Maine, and my husband and I visited his cabin that his grandfather built in Maine one summer, and they had a plaque on the wall which said, a wishbone ain't as likely to get ye as far as a backbone. And I laughed about that. And I said, Alan, I know that I come from a wishbone people. And he said, unfortunately, I come from a backbone people, and I wish I were a wishbone. So I would say Portuguese people would probably say they're more wishbone as a sensibility. And in fact, I signed my letters to Alan when we exchanged notes as wishbone, and he writes backbone. So I think that there is a, I wrote a story once when there was a dispute over some land my father had in the Azores, and it got really very heated. And my godmother and I said, let's just run at one point. And then we realized you really can't escape anywhere. Americans, you can hide from people, you can move, you can go away. But in the Azores, what we found is you can't escape. So what kind of sensibility do you have about that? But I would say if there's one word to describe Portuguese-American writing sensibility, it would be saudade.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I love this idea of the wishbone people. I think I know. That strikes me as a very writerly disposition.
Exactly. Like, that's why I think surprised. I think a lot of your listeners will say, well, I don't need to be Portuguese. I'm definitely wishbone.
And there's lots of great, I think a lot of the Luso-American writers that are in this issue are actually really writing about, you know, family back in the Azores. Published a couple of poems, and I think most of them were set in California, and most of them were from people who had family in the Azores. So I think there's obviously a really strong community of that in California.
Well, there's a huge community of that in California. My father was one of the leading lecturers on Portuguese culture in California. And in fact, he wrote a book that people still point to called The Portuguese in California. And there's a kind of interesting sense of being in such a vast open state when you've come from a small village. Absolutely. Or, an island. So I think that tension, or it's not always a conflict, it's just the way it is, really affected how I looked at writing and looked at that people can be sitting around doing nothing and they carry a certain inherent tension or dichotomy of who they internally are.
Yeah, I mean, that is rich writing fodder right there. So as you know, The Common publishes Writing with a Modern Sense of Place, and San Francisco is a huge part of this story that you've written. Could you tell us about writing the city and like how you put the treasure hunt together on the page?
Sure. I grew up on the east side of the Bay. I grew up in, I went to high school in Oakland, but the city to me was always like the Emerald City, the great place, the magical place. You know, and it was just going across one bridge to get there, but it seemed like a grand world to me. And so writing the city, my father was an historian, and we would go on these, they were kind of like treasure hunts. We would go on very funny walks around the city where we would, here's where the the laboratory of the Wizard of Green Street was. Here are the parrots of Telegraph Hill. My father, when he took us to Golden Gate Park, the Japanese tea gardens, which are very well known, said, oh, it was a Japanese businessman who invented the fortune cookie, but he didn't patent it. So, so it was really a way of falling back in love with the city. It was always the shining star when I was growing up. And so I think that it's a way of, if you can fall in love with a place, if it can be like a person to you, if you can open yourself up to what a city means, then it's a way of dealing with grief. And the father deliberately sends her out on this treasure hunt in the city so she can discover and rediscover and basically just keep moving and deal with grief that way by seeing that the world is something still magical and still with things you can discover. So San Francisco has always been that to me. And, just since I was a child, I have a lot of books about the interesting little tucked away places you can find in San Francisco. Like the you could do audio bathing. You really can go and listen to what they call the sound organ, which they built into the bay, and it makes this kind of groaning sound. To me, San Francisco was what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I feel the same way about New York City, where I live now, just the feeling that you can turn a corner and the world is new or different.
Yeah, absolutely. So in preparation for this conversation, I reread your story that we published in issue 18 of The Common, which is called Revenge in the Name of All Owls. It is such a great story, and it's been a favorite around the office among our interns especially. And it's also a story about family and loss and grief. So I felt like it was a very nice companion to the treasure hunt story. And it has this really lovely sense of community in it as well, of people helping each other and supporting each other. Could you talk more about that? Is that a hallmark of Luso American communities in your experience?
Well, I don't really know if I can speak to what it is now so much as when I was younger. There were a lot of the people came from the Azores, worked in the dairies or ranches in San Diego. A lot of them were fishermen or tuna fishermen and so forth. But so it's very different from the Portuguese population of the East Coast. But there were all these societies that were set up, like the IDES and the UPPEC, that were designed to help widows, to help families that would lose their husbands and needed insurance, needed support. So there were a lot of the Azores tends to be very religious. So a lot of the you might say the Catholicism came over with the wonderful saint statues and so forth that I thought were pretty magical. But I think that there was a sense of community in trying to keep some of the traditions alive and to look out for one another because, it was an era where the women raised the families. It didn't work so much. And I still think now there's a lot of pride in being Portuguese American. But the owl story, frankly, this is a dangerous thing to say, but it was kind of a gift because I wrote it really fast. It just came to me, and there are very few stories where that's happened to me, but it just came to me, and I did it in a couple of days, and I was so happy with it, and, it felt like a breath of life to me. So it was a gift. Mm-hmm. But I think that I'm trying to do a cycle of stories about people connected in the Portuguese community. So that's one of the stories where I'm experimenting with it. If there's a kind of a Portuguese Californian attitude, it's this, we love our solitude, but we want to do it together. So I would describe that. That's probably a good philosophy for writers anyway. But I wanted to do a cycle of stories that are based around this Portuguese restaurant that, involves not just grief, but learning secrets and taking care of one another. So I'm experimenting with seeing if there's a cycle that could turn into a book with those.
Yeah, you read my mind because my very next story was going to be about that. You know, I've read a couple drafts of stories that we didn't end up publishing and stories that we did. And in them, I've started to recognize some of the same characters popping up. And certainly I started recognizing the family restaurant that pops up in a couple stories. And I feel like we have these kind of weddings and these large events where I would see characters that I knew from other stories. And I love that.
Yeah, I love that kind of story. It's sort of, you know, like the Olive Kittredge kind of idea that you get some characters all the way through, but very different angles and very different tones. And it, you know, so just looking at different prisms of things, I suppose.
Yeah, it's true. If you see characters from different points of view and they pop up in different stories, you can see, you know, much more facets of them than you could see in just one story.
Yeah, and it's fun to know things about them that the people in the second story are not really seeing. So that's always fun too. So, that's one project that's kind of ongoing, but I have just finished as of literally a week ago, a new novel, which is, I've been working on for 15 years. I'm wow. embarrassed to say, and it's 570 pages. And that is with a lot of cuts made. But that is a story of immigration and civil. It's sort of a Love in the Time of Cholera set in the Civil War with Portuguese people. There really was a group of people from Madeira who emigrated due to religious violence because they had been converted to Presbyterianism. And they were adopted by Illinois at the time of Lincoln. And I found a character who courted a woman he met in the Lincoln household. And then he went away in the Union Army and lost her for 50 years. Mm-hmm. So I've been working, it feels like 50 years I've been working on this, but I've just now, what happened was I gave a talk at the Library of Congress when my first novel came out. And the woman in the Hispanic division there where I was giving the talk happened to be Brazilian. And she said, you know, there's some maps in the map division I think you would find really great. And they were called the Portuguese Protestants of Illinois, which made me laugh. I mean, we both laughed about that. But I began I didn't know it would take me 15 years to figure out the story and how to tell it. And but it is based on true events. And I'm not a Civil War buff, but it's also about the heart of America when an era when Americans were trying to figure out how much should we be about community and how much should we be about individual striving and rights. And obviously we're still working on that one.
For sure.
I have that sort of post-long book Snowdian blues, I guess, at the moment, but also relief. So that has been sent to my agent, and now the waiting begins.
That's so exciting. And also, I just want you to know that I really sympathize with the overlong novel because I'm struggling with the same problem right now. I'm, you know, trying to make it a more modest side.
How many years have you been?
Probably this is only the third year I've been working on it, but it wants to be long.
Let it be long. Yeah. Let it be long.
I think you'll sympathize. It's when you're writing about history in America, there's just too much to say, you know, like you were describing, like the comparison between the collective and the individual and like that balance and stuff. And, you know, when you're talking about stuff like that, it needs to stretch out a little.
Well, it does. And then, but it's really how many tributaries do you form? Mm-hmm. And the good news is that it's so complicated, it'll take you a long time. And by then, you're less attached to certain aspects of history. Like, for example, I found out there's a dye called, a lot of people probably know this, called cochineal, which is made of, it's a fuchsia color that's made of the bodies of female insects. And it was used in cooking. So you could have pink frosting and so forth. And Mary Todd Lincoln was a big dessert baker and eater. And so she had recipes in her cookbook with cochineal. And So I thought, I've got to get that in. And, you know, some of that just falls by the wayside. So I guess, you know, Emily, the good news is that if you work on it long enough, you'll get less attached to certain things and you'll just think, fine, it can go, fine, it can go. And you'll still end up with a lot.
Yeah, I think I might be at that stage now. Like I'm just, yeah, I'm so tired of looking at the same thing over and over again that if it doesn't spark joy, I get rid of it.
There you go. Yeah, I'm all for that.
But yeah, so many good juicy details in history. And the more research you do, the more you want to include and kind of the less you can include.
Well, it's, and it opens up and you want the panoramic feeling of the backdrop of time and what's going on. And then you think, okay, but this is also about what are my characters doing and so forth. So it's a real juggling act.
Yeah, for sure.
What era are you writing?
I'm writing about World War II, like the home front in America.
Oh, okay. So yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the great news is there's so much research and so much documentation. Like I'm sure, you know, writing about the Civil War is probably much more difficult because we have, you know, less primary sources and that kind of thing. But sometimes I think a lot of research just makes it harder.
Well, it does. And then you sort of dread what you're going to find out because it'll be so good you won't want to give it up. And yeah, I mean, I found about battles that were not really written very much about, but that seemed really extremely, my character was actually in those battles. Mm-hmm. And there was something called the Meridian Raid, which was something I did a lot of research about, and there was very little about it. So I also had fun doing the research. And then I think you're supposed to get four times more than you think you need and then start cutting.
Okay. That's good to know. I was going to ask you about this sort of, in your career, you've written several short story collections. You've also written two novels and now three. What is it that about stories that really appeals to you? Like, is there something that you go to stories for that you don't go to novels for, either in reading or in writing?
I like the size of them. I like the feeling that you're supposed to. And Nadine Gordimer has a lovely line that I'm not going to get quite correct, but she says that stories are a drop of human fluid. And so I think that's a good way to look at it. It's like, how can I tell the world in 10 pages or 30 pages or something like that. I like the creativity that comes from confinement in that way. And can I get this all down in a quick moving way? And then novels are, of course, building a whole world. So I think they're different. Well, let me correct that. I think they're different ways of building a world. You want the whole world in a short story and you want it in a novel too. But frankly, I like the feeling that you can accomplish a story in a few pages. I like the art of that. It doesn't necessarily follow that it's in a short amount of time that you can do a story, as the story that we started talking about that I did for The Common, The Treasure Hunt of August Diaz, was in my mind for, I don't know, 15, 20 years. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote it in maybe 2 weeks, I'm forgetting exactly. So I wasn't really working on it, but it was in my head.
Right. I also, you know, I love that thing about short stories that you described with the owl story, where it just comes, it downloads right from your brain onto the page and then it's done. And it's a miracle.
It's a miracle. They don't seem to come as often as we'd like.
No.
But when I was doing the novel, I would just look at these chapters. They were just a gaping hole that I was working with a freelance editor helping me. And he would say, okay, you need to do this in this chapter. And I would just look at it and think, okay, just do it. And I tried to write quickly so that it would have a feeling of ease and lightness when I was doing it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I think that they're different. I mean, one's a symphony and one's, you know, more of a shorter piece, and they're both music.
Yeah, definitely very different skills. Yeah. I would love to hear, just because I'm personally curious, your novel, Mariana, I first learned about when I was reading another essay that appears in the issue by Una Patrick, which mentions this nun, Mariana. Would mm-hmm. you just tell our listeners a little bit about that novel?
Oh, I had, that was a lot of research. there's a nun called Mariana Alcufarado is her last name, from Beja, B-E-J-A, in Portugal. And at the time, you know, the 18th century, girls were actually put into the convent, not because they had a vocation, but because their rich fathers didn't want to divide their land among too many sons-in-law. Uh-huh. And so they had like little cities of women. They had affairs, they had studio apartments. In some ways, they were freer than their married sisters. And there's one nun in particular who is said to have written 5 love letters to a French cavalry officer with whom she had an affair when France came to aid Portugal in the war against Spain. It was said that France was doing this because they were looking at Portugal as really wonderful beachfront property for France. But there's an academic argument that it was a French author who invented her. The Portuguese believe that she was a real person, and they have research and documentation to prove that. But I thought, I don't want to argue about that. I just want to write a novel about her life, because I'm interested in solitary women and what do they do with that, and how does passion translate into art. The letters are considered some of the most romantic documents in existence, and to the point that Rilke wrote about her, Matisse did drawings imagining her, so did Modigliani. She was famous in Europe. And so when I wrote the novel, I wanted to just tell a life story of this woman as I, using my research, envisioned it. The book did really well in Europe. This nun is really popular in Germany because of Rilke. And some of the most fun I had as a writer were with this novel, because I went on a book tour in Italy, which was really a hoot.
That sounds great.
but I would say it's about the passions of a nun who had to figure out how to translate a sexual passion and romance into art and then into life, because, you know, she was young when she had this affair and lived a long life.
That's great. I have got to pick up this novel. It sounds so great. Is there anything else that we should know that you're working on? Like, what's next from you beyond this novel and the stories that you're working on?
Well, I've kind of done a total collapse after finishing this long novel. And I think that probably after that, I'm going to look at those stories in that cycle that the owl story is probably in, and maybe the treasure hunt of August Diaz. I'm not sure, to kind of warm around, I tend to do short stories after I've done a novel, just because I want to, plunging into a long novel is a real commitment and a story I can back out of. So
for sure.
after I just get my energy back, I think I'll look at some of those stories that are like the ones that The Common has published.
That's great. I think you deserve a break and you should take it.
yeah. I mean, my school was run by Spanish nuns, so I always feel guilty if I'm not working.
I see.
yeah. I need to get over that. But also we moved in New York during the pandemic. Oh, and wow. So, they're settling in to do.
You have boxes. So,
yeah. There are a lot of boxes.
I understand.
yeah. There are a few boxes.
Well, it has been so great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us. I really enjoyed this. Thanks so much for making time.
Well, Emily, thank you so, so much. And really, thank you, from the bottom of my heart to you and everyone at The Common, because you've made me feel like I have a wonderful literary home.
Oh, well, we would love to be that home for you. Okay. Listeners, you can read Catherine's story, The Treasure Hunt of August Diaz, and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.